This is Audible.
Rama 2 by Arthur C. Clarke and Gentry Lee. Read by Toby Longworth. Chapter 1 Rama Returns. The great radar pulse generator Excalibur, powered by nuclear explosions, had been out of service for almost half a century. It had been designed and developed in a frantic effort during the months following the transit of Rama through the solar system. When it was first declared operational in 2132, Excalibur's announced purpose was to give Earth ample warning of any future alien visitors. One as gigantic as Rama could be detected at interstellar distances, years, it was hoped, before it could have any effect on human affairs. The decision to build Excalibur had been made even before Rama had passed perihelion. As the first extraterrestrial visitor rounded the sun and headed out towards the stars, armies of scientists studied the data from the only mission that had been able to rendezvous with the intruder. Rama, they announced, was an intelligent robot with absolutely no interest in our solar system or its inhabitants. The official report offered no explanations for the many mysteries encountered by the investigators. However, the experts did convince themselves that they understood one basic principle of Raman engineering. Since most of the major systems and subsystems encountered inside Rama by the human explorers had two functional backups, it appeared that the aliens engineered everything in threes. Therefore, since the entire giant vehicle was assumed to be a machine, it was considered highly likely that two more Rama spacecraft would be following the first visitor. But no new spaceships entered the solar neighborhood from the empty reaches of interstellar space. As the years passed, the people on Earth confronted more pressing problems. Concern about the Ramans, or whoever it was that had created that drab cylinder 50 kilometers long, abated as the lone alien incursion passed into history. The visit of Rama continued to intrigue many scholars, but most members of the human species were forced to pay attention to other issues. By the early 2140s, the world was in the grip of a severe economic crisis. There was no money left to maintain Excalibur. Its few scientific discoveries could not justify the enormous expense of assuring the safety of its operation. The great nuclear pulse generator was abandoned. 45 years later, it took 33 months to return Excalibur to operational status. The primary justification for the refurbishment of Excalibur was scientific. During the intervening years, radar science had flourished and produced new methods of data interpretation that had greatly enhanced the value of the Excalibur observations. As the generator again took images of the distant heavens, almost nobody on Earth was expecting the arrival of another Rama spacecraft. The operations manager at Excalibur Station did not even inform his supervisor the first time the strange blip appeared on his data processing display. He thought it was an artifact, a bogey created by an anomalous processing algorithm. When the signature repeated several times, however, he paid closer attention. The manager called in the chief Excalibur scientist, who analyzed the data and decided the new object was a long-period comet. It was another 2 months before a graduate student proved that the signature belonged to a smooth body at least 40 kilometers in its longest dimension. By 2179, the world knew that the object hurtling through the solar system toward the inner planets was a second extraterrestrial spacecraft. The International Space Agency, ISA, concentrated its resources to prepare a mission that would intercept the intruder just inside the orbit of Venus in late February of 2200. Again, the eyes of humanity looked outwards, toward the stars, and the deep philosophical questions raised by the first Rama were again debated by the populace on Earth. As the new visitor drew nearer and its physical characteristics were more carefully resolved by the host of sensors aimed in its direction, it was confirmed that this alien spacecraft, at least from the outside, was identical to its predecessor. Rama had returned. Mankind had a second appointment with destiny. Chapter 2 Test and Training. The bizarre metallic creature inched along the wall, crawling up towards the overhang. It resembled a skinny armadillo, its jointed snail body covered by a thin shell that curled over and around a compact grouping of electronic gadgetry astride the middle of its three sections. A helicopter hovered about 2 meters away from the wall. A long, flexible arm with a pincer on the end extended from the nose of the helicopter and just missed closing its jaws around the odd creature. "Damn it," muttered Janos Taburi. "This is almost impossible with the copter bouncing around. Even in perfect conditions, it's hard to do precision work with these claws at full extension." He glanced over at the pilot. "And why can't this fantastic flying machine keep its altitude and attitude constant?" "Move the helicopter closer to the wall," ordered Dr. David Brown. Hiro Yamanaka looked at Brown without expression and entered a command into the control console. The screen in front of him flashed red and printed out the message, "Command unacceptable. Insufficient tolerances." Yamanaka said nothing. The helicopter continued to hover in the same spot. "We have 50 centimeters, maybe 75, between the blades and the wall," Brown thought out loud. "In another 2 or 3 minutes, the biot will be safe under the overhang. Let's go to manual and grab it. Now, no mistakes this time, Taburi." For an instant, a dubious Hiro Yamanaka stared at the balding, bespectacled scientist sitting in the seat behind him. Then the pilot turned, entered another command into the console, and switched the large black lever to the left position. The monitor flashed, in manual mode, no automatic protection. Yamanaka gingerly eased the helicopter closer to the wall. Engineer Taburi was ready. He inserted his hands in the instrumented gloves and practiced opening and closing the jaws at the end of the flexible arm. Again, the arm extended, and the two mechanical mandibles deftly closed around the jointed snail and its shell. The feedback loops from the sensors and the claws told Taburi, through his gloves, that he had successfully captured his prey. "I've got it!" he shouted exultantly. He began the slow process of bringing the quarry back into the helicopter. A sudden draft of wind rolled the helicopter to the left, and the arm with the biot banged against the wall. Taburi felt his grip loosening. "Straighten it up!" he cried, continuing to retract the arm. While Yamanaka was struggling to null the rolling motion of the helicopter, he inadvertently tipped the nose down just slightly. The three crew members heard the sickening sound of the metal rotor blades crashing against the wall. The Japanese pilot immediately pushed the emergency button, and the craft returned to automatic control. In less than a second, a whining alarm sounded, and the cockpit monitor flashed red. "Excessive damage, high probability of failure, eject crew." Yamanaka did not hesitate. Within moments, he blasted out of the cockpit and had his parachute deployed. Taburi and Brown followed. As soon as the Hungarian engineer removed his hands from the special gloves, the claws at the end of the mechanical arm relaxed, and the armadillo creature fell 100 meters to the flat plain below, smashing into thousands of tiny pieces. The pilotless helicopter descended erratically toward the plain. Even with its onboard automatic landing algorithm active and in complete control, the damaged flying machine bounced hard on its struts when it hit the ground and tipped over on its side. Not far from the helicopter's landing site, a portly man, wearing a brown military suit covered with ribbons, jumped down from an open elevator. He had just descended from the mission control center and was clearly agitated as he walked briskly to a waiting rover. He was followed by a scrambling, lithe blonde woman in an ISA flight suit, with camera equipment hanging over both her shoulders. The military man was General Valery Bortsov, commander-in-chief of Project Newton. "Anyone hurt?" he asked the occupant of the rover, electrical engineer Richard Wakefield.
"Janos apparently banged his shoulder pretty hard during the ejection, but Nicole just radioed that he had no broken bones or separations, only a lot of bruises."
General Bortsov climbed into the front seat of the rover beside Wakefield, who was sitting behind the vehicle control panel. The blonde woman, video journalist Francesca Sabatini, stopped recording the scene and started to open the back door of the rover. Bortsov abruptly waved her away.
"Go check on Desjardins and Taburi," he said, pointing across the level plain. "Wilson's probably there already."
Bortsov and Wakefield headed in the opposite direction in the rover. They traveled about 400 meters before they pulled alongside a slight man, about 50, in a new flight suit. David Brown was busy folding up his parachute and replacing it in a stuff bag. General Bortsov stepped down from the rover and approached the American scientist.
"Are you all right, Dr. Brown?" the general asked.
obviously impatient to dispense with the preliminaries. Brown nodded, but did not reply.
In that case, General Bortsov continued in a measured tone, perhaps you could tell me what you are thinking about when you ordered Yamanaka to go to Manuel. It might be better if we discussed it here, away from the rest of the crew. Did you even see the warning lights? Bortsov added after a lengthy silence. Did you consider, even for a moment, that the safety of the other cosmonauts might be jeopardized by the maneuver?
Dr. David Brown eventually looked over at Bortsov with a sullen, baleful stare. When he finally spoke, his speech was clipped and strained, belying the emotion he was suppressing. It seemed reasonable to move the helicopter just a little closer to the target. We had some clearance left, and it was the only way that we could have captured the Bayat. Our mission, after all, is to bring home... You don't need to tell me what our mission is, Bortsov interrupted with passion. Remember, I helped write the policies myself. And I will remind you again that the number one priority at all times is the safety of the crew, especially during these simulations. I must tell you that I am absolutely flabbergasted by this crazy stunt of yours. The helicopter is damaged. Taburi is injured. You're lucky that nobody was killed.
David Brown was no longer paying attention to General Bortsov. He had turned around to finish stuffing his parachute into its transparent package. From the set of his shoulders and the energy he was expending on this routine task, it was obvious that he was very angry. Bortsov returned to the rover. After waiting for several seconds, he offered Dr. Brown a ride back to the base. The American shook his head without saying anything, hoisted his pack onto his back, and walked off in the direction of the helicopter and the elevator.
Chapter 3 Crew Conference. Outside the meeting room in the training facility, Janos Taburi was sitting on an auditorium chair underneath an array of small but powerful portable lights. The distance to the simulated biot was as the limit of the reach of the mechanical arm, he explained to the tiny camera that Francesca Sabatini was holding. Twice I tried to grab it and failed. Dr. Brown then decided to put the helicopter on manual and take it a little closer to the wall. We caught some wind. The door from the conference room opened, and a smiling, ruddy face appeared.
We're all here waiting for you, said General O'Toole, pleasantly. I think Bortsov's becoming a little impatient.
Francesca switched off the lights and put her video camera back in the pocket of her flight suit.
All right, my Hungarian hero, she said with a laugh. We'd better stop for now. You know how our leader dislikes waiting.
She walked over and put her arms gently around the small man. She patted him on his bandaged shoulder.
But we're really glad you're all right.
A handsome black man in his early 40s had been sitting just out of the camera frame during the interview, taking notes on a flat, rectangular keyboard about a foot square. He followed Francesca and Janos into the conference room.
I want to do a feature this week on the new design concepts in the teleoperation of the arm and the glove, Reggie Wilson whispered to Taburi as they sat down. There are a bunch of my readers out there who find all this technical crap absolutely fascinating.
I'm glad that the three of you could join us, Bortsov's sarcastic voice boomed across the conference room. I was starting to think that perhaps a crew meeting was an imposition on all of you. An activity that interrupted the far more important tasks of reporting our misadventures or writing erudite scientific and engineering papers.
He pointed at Reggie Wilson, whose ubiquitous flat keyboard was on the table in front of him.
Wilson, believe it or not, you're supposed to be a member of this crew first and a journalist second. Just one time do you think you can put that damn thing away and listen? I have a few things to say and I want them to be off the record.
Wilson removed the keyboard and put it in his briefcase. Bortsov stood up and walked around the room as he talked. The table in the crew conference room was a long oval, about 2 meters across at its widest point. There were 12 places around the table. Guests and observers, when they attended, sat in the extra chairs over against the walls. Each one equipped with a computer keyboard and monitor slightly inset into the surface and covered, when not being used, by a polished grain top that matched the quality simulated wood on the rest of the table. As always, the other two military men on the expedition, European Admiral Otto Heilmann, the hero of the Council of Governments intercession in the Caracas crisis, and American Air Force General Michael Ryan O'Toole, flanked Bortsov at one end of the oval.
The other 9 Newton crew members did not always sit in the same seats, a fact that particularly frustrated the compulsively orderly Admiral Hohmann and, to a lesser extent, his commanding officer, Butzov. Sometimes the 4 non-professionals in the crew would cluster together around the other end of the table, leaving the space cadets, as the 5 cosmonaut graduates of the Space Academy were known, to create a buffer zone in the middle. After almost a year of constant media attention, the public had relegated each member of the Newton Dozen to 1 of 3 subgroups. The non-pros, consisting of the 2 scientists and 2 journalists, the military troika, and the 5 cosmonauts who did most of the skilled work during the mission. On this particular day, however, the 2 non-military groups were thoroughly mixed. The famed Japanese interdisciplinary scientist, Shigeru Takagishi, widely regarded as the foremost expert in the world on the first Raman expedition 70 years earlier, and also the author of the Atlas of Rama that was required reading for all of the crew, was sitting in the middle of the oval between Soviet pilot Irina Turgenev and the brilliant but often zany British cosmonaut and electrical engineer Richard Wakefield. Opposite them were life science officer Nicole Desjardins, a statuesque copper-brown woman with a fascinating French and African lineage, the quiet, almost mechanical Japanese pilot Yamanaka, and the stunning Signora Sabatini. The final 3 positions at the south end of the oval, facing the large maps and diagrams of Rama on the opposite wall, were occupied by American journalist Wilson, the inimitable and garrulous Taburi, a Soviet cosmonaut from Budapest, and Dr. David Brown. Brown looked very businesslike and serious. He had a set of papers spread out in front of him as the meeting began. "It is inconceivable to me," Butzov was saying while he strode purposely around the room, "that any of you could ever forget, even for a moment, that you have been selected to go on what could be the most important human mission of all time. But on the basis of this last set of simulations, I must admit that I am beginning to have my doubts about some of you. There are those who believe that this Rama craft will be a copy of its predecessor," Butzov continued, "and that it will be equally uninterested and uninvolved with whatever trifling creatures come to survey it. I admit it certainly appears to be at least the same size and same configuration, based on the radar data that we have been processing for the past 3 years. But even if it does turn out to be another dead ship built by aliens that vanished thousands of years ago, this mission is still the most important one of our lifetime, and I would think that it demands the very best effort from each of you." The Soviet general paused to collect his thoughts. Janos Taburi started to ask a question, but Butzov interrupted him and launched again into his monologue. "Our performance as a crew on this last set of training exercises has been absolutely abominable. Some of you have been outstanding. You know who you are. But just as many of you have acted as if you have no idea what this mission was about. I am convinced that 2 or 3 of you do not even read the relevant procedures or the protocol listings before the exercises begin. I grant you that they are dull and sometimes tedious, but all of you agreed, when you accepted your appointments 10 months ago, to learn the procedures and to follow the protocols and project policies. Even those of you with no prior flight experience." Butzov had stopped in front of one of the large maps on the wall, this one an inset view of one corner of the city of New York, inside the first Raman spaceship. The area of tall, thin buildings resembling Manhattan skyscrapers, all huddled together on an island in the middle of the cylindrical sea, had been partially mapped during the previous human encounter. "In 6 weeks, we will rendezvous with an unknown space vehicle, perhaps one containing a city like this, and all of mankind will depend on us to represent them. We have no way of knowing what we will find. Whatever preparation we will have completed before then may well be not enough. Our knowledge of our pre-planned procedures must be perfect and automatic, so that our brains are free to deal with any new conditions we may encounter." The commander sat down at the head of the table. "Today's exercise was nearly a complete disaster. We could easily have lost 3 valuable members of our team, as well as one of the most expensive helicopters ever built. I want to remind you all, one more time, of the priorities of this mission as agreed to by the International Space Agency and the Council of Governments. The top priority is the safety of the crew. Second priority is the analysis and or determination of any threat, if it exists, to the human population of the planet Earth." Butzov was now looking directly down the table at Brown, who returned the commander's challenging look with a stony stare of his own.
Only after those two priorities are satisfied, and the Raman craft is adjudged harmless, does the capturing of one or more of the Biots have any significance.
I would like to remind General Bortsov, David Brown said almost immediately in his sonorous voice, that some of us do not believe the priorities should be blindly applied in a serial fashion. The importance of the Biots to the scientific community cannot be overstated. As I have said repeatedly, both in cosmonaut meetings and on my many television news appearances, if this second Rama craft is just like the first, which means that it will ignore our existence completely, and we proceed so slowly that we fail even to capture a single Biot before we must abandon the alien ship and return to Earth, then an absolute unique opportunity for science will have been sacrificed to assuage the collective anxiety of the world's politicians. Bortsov started to reply, but Brown stood up and gestured emphatically with his hands. No, no. Hear me out. You have essentially accused me of incompetence in my conduct of today's exercise, and I have a right to respond. He held up some computer printout and waved it at Bortsov. Here are the initial conditions for today's simulation, as posted and defined by your engineers. Let me refresh your memory with a few of the more salient points, in case you've forgotten. Background condition number one. It is near the end of the mission, and it has already been firmly established that Ramak II is totally passive and represents no threat to the planet Earth. Background condition number two. During the expedition, Biots have only been seen sporadically, and never in groups. Brown could tell from the body language of the rest of the crew that his presentation had had a successful beginning. He drew a breath and continued. I assumed, after reading those background conditions, that this particular exercise might represent the last chance to capture a Biot. During the test, I kept thinking what it would mean if we could bring one or several of them back to Earth. In all the history of humanity, the only absolute certain contact with an extraterrestrial culture took place in 2130, when our cosmonauts boarded that first Rama spaceship. Yet, the long-term scientific benefit from that encounter was less than it might have been. Granted, we have reams of remote sensing data from that first investigation, including the information from the detailed dissection of the spider bot done by Dr. Laura Ernst. But the cosmonauts brought home only one artifact, a tiny piece of some kind of biomechanical flower, whose physical characteristics had already irreversibly changed before any of its mysteries could be understood. We have nothing else in the way of souvenirs from that first excursion. No ashtrays, no drinking glasses, not even a transistor from a piece of equipment that would teach us something about Raman engineering. Now we have a second chance. Brown looked up at the circular ceiling above him. His voice was full of power. If we could somehow find and return two or three different Biots to the Earth, and if we could then analyze these creatures to unlock their secrets, then this mission would without doubt be the most significant historical event of all time. For in understanding in depth the engineering minds of the Ramans, we would, in a real sense, achieve a first contact. Even Bortsov was impressed. As he often did, David Brown had used his eloquence to turn a defeat into a partial victory. The Soviet general decided to alter his tactics. Still, Bortsov said in a subdued tone during the pause in Brown's rhetoric, we must never forget that human lives are at stake on this mission, and that we must do nothing to jeopardize their safety. He looked around the table at the rest of the crew. I want to bring back Biots and other samples from Rama as much as any of you, he continued. But I must confess that this blithe assumption that the second craft will be exactly like the first disturbs me a great deal. What evidence do we have from the first encounter that the Ramans, or whoever they are benevolent? None at all. It could be dangerous to seize a Biot too soon. But there's no way of ever being certain, Commander. One way or the other. Richard Wakefield spoke from the side of the table between Bortsov and Brown.
Even if we verify that this spaceship is exactly like the first one almost 70 years ago, we still have no information about what will happen once we make a concerted effort to capture a Biot. I mean, suppose for a moment that the two ships are just super-sophisticated robots engineered millions of years ago by a now-vanished race from the opposite side of the galaxy.
How can we predict what kinds of subroutines might be programmed into those biots to deal with hostile acts? What if the biots are integral parts, in some way that we have not been able to discern of the fundamental operation of the ship? Then it would be natural, even though they are machines, that they would be programmed to defend themselves. And it is conceivable that what might look like an initial hostile act on our part could be the trigger that changes the way the entire ship functions. I remember reading about the robot lander that crashed into the Ethane Sea on Titan in 2012. It had stored entirely different sequences, depending on what it...
Halt!
Janos Tabori interrupted with a friendly smile.
The arcana of the early robotic exploration of the solar system is not on the agenda for today's post-mortem.
He looked down the table at Bortsov.
Skipper, my shoulder is hurting, my stomach is empty, and the excitement of today's exercise has left me exhausted. All this talk is wonderful, but if there's no more specific business, would it be out of line to suggest an early end to this meeting, so that we will have adequate time for once to pack our bags?
Admiral Heilmann leaned forward on the table.
Cosmonaut Tabui, General Bortsov is in charge of the crew meetings. It is up to him to determine.
The Soviet commander waved his arm at Heilmann.
Enough, Otto. I think that Janos is right. It has been a long day at the end of an extremely busy 17 days of activity. This conversation will be better when we are all fresh.
Bortsov stood up.
All right. We will break for now. The shuttles will leave for the airport right after dinner.
The crew started preparing to leave.
During your short rest period, Bortsov said as an afterthought, I want all of you to think about where we are in the schedule. We have left only 2 more weeks of simulations here at the training center before the break for the end-of-year holiday. Immediately thereafter, we begin the intensive pre-launch activities. This next set of exercises is our last chance to get it right. I expect each of you to return fully prepared for the remaining work, and recommitted to the importance of this mission.
Chapter 4 The Great Chaos. The intrusion of the first Raman spacecraft into the inner solar system in early 2130 had a powerful impact on human history. Although there were no immediate changes in everyday life after the crew headed by Commander Norton returned from encountering Rama 1, the clear and unambiguous proof that a vastly superior intelligence existed, or as a minimum had existed, somewhere else in the universe, forced a rethinking of the place of Homo sapiens in the overall scheme of the cosmos. It was now apparent that other chemicals, doubtless also fabricated in the great stellar cataclysms of the heavens, had risen to consciousness in some other place, at some other time. Who were these Ramans? Why had they built a giant sophisticated spacecraft and sent it on an excursion into our neighborhood? Both in public and private conversation, the Ramans were the number one topic of interest for many months. For well over a year, mankind waited more or less patiently for another sign of the Ramans' presence in the universe. Intense telescopic investigations were conducted at all wavelengths to see if any additional information associated with the retreating alien spacecraft could be identified. Nothing was found. The heavens were quiet. The Ramans were departing as swiftly and inexplicably as they had arrived. Once Excalibur was operational, and its initial search of the heavens turned up nothing new, there was a noticeable change in the collective human attitude toward that first contact with Rama. Overnight, the encounter became a historical event, something that had happened and was now completed. The tenor of newspaper and magazine articles that had earlier begun with phrases like, "When the Ramans return," changed to, "If there is ever another encounter with the creatures who built the huge spaceship discovered in 2130. What had been a perceived threat, a lean, in a sense, on future human behavior, was quickly reduced to a historical curiosity. There was no longer an urgency to deal with such fundamental issues as the return of the Ramans, or the destiny of the human race in a universe peopled by intelligent creatures. Mankind relaxed, at least for a moment. Then it exploded in a paroxysm of narcissistic behavior that made all previous historical periods of individual selfishness pale by comparison. The surge of unabashed self-indulgence on a global scale was easy to understand. Something fundamental in the human psyche had changed as a result of the encounter with Rama 1. Prior to that contact,
humanity stood alone as the only known example of advanced intelligence in the universe. The idea that humans could, as a group, control their destiny far into the future had been a significant linchpin in almost every working philosophy of life. That the Ramans existed, or had existed, whatever the tense, the philosophic logic came to the same conclusion, changed everything. Mankind was not unique, maybe not even special. It was just a question of time before the prevailing homocentric notion of the universe was to become irrevocably shattered by clearer awareness of the others. Thus, it was easy to comprehend why the life patterns of most human beings suddenly veered toward self-gratification, reminding literary scholars of a similar time, almost exactly 5 centuries earlier, when Robert Herrick had exhorted the virgins to make the most of their fleeting time in a poem that began, "Gather ye rosebuds while ye may, old time is still a-flying." An unrestrained burst of conspicuous consumption and global greed lasted for just under 2 years. Frantic acquisition of everything the human mind could create was superimposed on a weak economic infrastructure that had been already poised for a downturn in early 2130, when the first Raman spaceship flew through the inner solar system. The looming recession was first postponed throughout 2130 and 2131 by the combined manipulative efforts of governments and financial institutions, even though the fundamental economic weaknesses were never addressed. With the renewed burst of buying in early 2132, the world jumped directly into another period of rapid growth. Production capacities were expanded, stock markets exploded, and both consumer confidence and total employment hit all-time highs. There was unprecedented prosperity, and the net result was a short-term but significant improvement in the standard of living for almost all humans. By the end of the year in 2133, it had become obvious to some of the more experienced observers of human history that the Raman boom was leading mankind towards disaster. Dire warnings of impending economic doom started being heard above the euphoric shouts of the millions who had recently vaulted into the middle and upper classes. Suggestions to balance budgets and limit credit at all levels of the economy were ignored. Instead, creative effort was expended to come up with one way after another of putting more spending power in the hands of a populace that had forgotten how to say wait, much less no, to itself. The global stock market began to sputter in January of 2134, and there were predictions of a coming crash. But to most humans spread around the Earth and throughout the scattered colonies in the solar system, the concept of such a crash was beyond comprehension. After all, the world economy had been expanding for over 9 years, the last 2 years at a rate unparalleled in the previous 2 centuries. World leaders insisted that they had finally found the mechanisms that could truly inhibit the downturns of the capitalistic cycles. And the people believed them, until early May of 2134. During the first 3 months of the year, the global stock markets went inexorably down, slowly at first, then in significant drops. Many people, reflecting the superstitious attitude towards cometary visitors that had been prevalent for 2,000 years, somehow associated the stock market's difficulties with the return of Halley's Comet. Its appearance, starting in March, turned out to be far brighter than anyone expected. For weeks, scientists all over the world were competing with each other to explain why it was so much more brilliant than originally predicted. After it swooped past perihelion in late March and began to appear in the evening sky in mid-April, its enormous tail dominated the heavens. In contrast, terrestrial affairs were dominated by the emerging world economic crisis. On May the 1st, 2134, 3 of the largest international banks announced that they were insolvent because of bad loans. Within 2 days, a panic had spread around the world. The more than 1 billion home terminals with access to the global financial markets were used to dump individual portfolios of stocks and bonds. The communications load on the global network system was immense. GNS data transfer machines were stretched far beyond their capabilities and design specifications. Data gridlock delayed transactions for minutes, then hours, contributing additional momentum to the panic. By the end of a week, 2 things were apparent: that over half of the world's stock value had been obliterated, and that many individuals, large and small investors alike, who had used their credit options to the maximum, were now
virtually penniless. The supporting databases that kept track of personal bank accounts and automatically transferred money to cover margin calls were flashing disaster messages in almost 20% of the houses in the world. In truth, however, the situation was much, much worse. Only a small percentage of the transactions were actually clearing through all the supporting computers, because the data rates in all directions were far beyond anything that had ever been anticipated. In computer language, the entire global financial system went into the cycle-slip mode. Billions and billions of information transfers at lower priorities were postponed by the network of computers, while the higher priority tasks were being serviced first. The net result of these data delays was that in most cases individual electronic bank accounts were not properly debited, for hours or even days, to account for the mounting stock market losses. Once the individual investors realized what was occurring, they rushed to spend whatever was still showing in their balances before the computers completed all the transactions. By the time governments and financial institutions understood fully what was going on and acted to stop all this frenetic activity, it was too late. The confused system had crashed completely. To reconstruct what had happened required carefully dumping and interleaving the backup checkpoint files stored at 100 or so remote centers around the world. For over 3 weeks, the electronic financial management system that governed all money transactions was inaccessible to everybody. Nobody knew how much money he had, or how much anyone else had. Since cash had long ago become obsolete, only eccentrics and collectors had enough banknotes to buy even a week's groceries. People began to barter for necessities. Pledges based on friendship and personal acquaintance enabled many people to survive temporarily. But the pain had only begun. Every time the international management organization that oversaw the global financial system would announce that they were going to try to come back online and would plead with people to stay off their terminals except for emergencies, their pleas would be ignored. Processing requests would flood the system, and the computers would crash again. It was only 2 more weeks before the scientists of the world agreed on an explanation for the additional brightness in the apparition of Halley's Comet. But it was over 4 months before people could count again on reliable database information from the GNS. The cost to human society of the enduring chaos was incalculable. By the time normal electronic economic activity had been restored, the world was in a violent financial downspin that would not bottom out until 12 years later. It would be well over 50 years before the gross world product would return to the heights reached before the crash of 2134. Chapter 5. After the Crash. There is unanimous agreement that the Great Chaos profoundly altered human civilization in every way. No segment of society was immune. The catalyst for the relatively rapid collapse of the existing institutional infrastructure was the market crash and subsequent breakdown of the global financial system. However, these events would not have been sufficient by themselves to project the world into a period of unprecedented depression. What followed the initial crash would have been only a comedy of errors if so many lives had not been lost as a result of the poor planning. Inept world political leaders first denied or ignored the existing economic problems, then overreacted with a suite of individual measures that were baffling and/or inconsistent, and finally threw up their arms in despair as the global crisis deepened and spread. Attempts to coordinate international solutions were doomed to failure by the increasing need of each of the sovereign nations to respond to its own constituency. In hindsight, it was obvious that the internationalization of the world that had taken place during the 21st century had been flawed in at least one significant way. Although many activities, communications, trade, transportation, including space, currency regulation, peacekeeping, information exchange, and environmental protection, to name the most important, had indeed become international, even interplanetary, considering the space colonies. Most of the agreements that established these international institutions contained codicils that allowed the individual nations to withdraw upon relatively short notice if the policies promulgated under the accords no longer served the interests of the country in question. In short, each of the nations participating in the creation of an international body had the right to abrogate its national involvement, unilaterally, when it was no longer satisfied with the actions of the group.
The years preceding the rendezvous with the first Raman spaceship in early 2130 had been an extraordinarily stable and prosperous time. After the world recovered from the devastating cometary impact near Padua, Italy, in 2077, there was an entire half-century of moderate growth. Except for a few relatively short and not too severe economic recessions, living conditions improved in a wide range of countries throughout the time period. Isolated wars and civil disturbances did erupt from time to time, primarily in the undeveloped nations. But the concerted efforts of the global peacekeeping forces always contained these problems before they became too serious. There were no major crises that tested the stability of the new international mechanisms. Immediately following the encounter with Rama One, however, there were rapid changes in the basic governing apparatus. First, emergency appropriations to handle Excalibur and other large Rama-related projects drained revenues from established programs. Then, starting in 2132, a loud clamor for tax cuts to put more money into the hands of the individuals reduced even further the allocations for needed services. By late 2133, most of the newer international institutions had become understaffed and inefficient. Thus, the global market crash took place in an environment where there was already growing doubt in the minds of the populace about the efficacy of the entire network of international organizations. As the financial chaos continued, it was an easy step for the individual nations to stop contributing funds to the very global organizations that might have been able to turn the tide of disaster if they had been used properly, that were vitiated by the near-sighted political leaders. The horrors of the Great Chaos have been chronicled in thousands of history texts. In the first 2 years, the major problems were skyrocketing unemployment and bankruptcies, both personal and corporate. But these financial difficulties seemed unimportant as the ranks of the homeless and starving continued to swell. Tent and box communities appeared in the public parks of all the big cities by the winter of 2136 to 37. And the municipal governments responded by striving valiantly to find ways to provide services to them. These services were intended to limit the difficulties created by the supposedly temporary presence of these hordes of idle and underfed individuals. But when the economy did not recover, the squalid tent cities did not disappear. Instead, they became permanent fixtures of urban life, growing cancers that were worlds unto themselves, with an entire set of activities and interests fundamentally different from the host cities that were supporting them. As more time passed, and the tent communities turned into hopeless, restless cauldrons of despair, these new enclaves in the middle of the metropolitan areas threatened to boil over and destroy the very entities that were allowing them to exist. Despite the anxiety caused by this constant Damocles' sword of urban anarchy, the world squeaked through the brutally cold winter of 2137 to 38, with the basic fabric of modern civilization still more or less intact. In early 2138, a remarkable series of events occurred in Italy. These events focused around a single individual named Michael Balatresi, a young Franciscan novitiate who would later become known everywhere as St. Michael of Siena, occupied much of the attention of the world, and temporarily forestalled the disintegration of the society. Michael was a brilliant combination of genius and spirituality, and political skills, a charismatic polyglot speaker with an unerring sense of purpose and timing. He suddenly appeared on the world stage in Tuscany, coming seemingly out of nowhere, with a passionate religious message that appealed to the hearts and minds of many of the world's frightened and/or disenfranchised citizens. His following grew rapidly and spontaneously and paid no heed to international boundaries. He became a potential threat to almost all the identified leadership coteries of the world with his unwavering call for a collective response to the problems besetting the species. When he was martyred under appalling circumstances in June of 2138, mankind's last spark of optimism seemed to perish. The civilized world that had been held together for many months by a flicker of hope and a slim thread of tradition abruptly crumbled into pieces. The 4 years from 2138 to 2142 were not good years to be alive. The litany of human woes was almost endless. Famine, disease, and lawlessness were everywhere. Small wars and revolutions were too numerous to count. There was an almost total breakdown in the standard institutions of modern civilization,
creating a phantasmagoric life for everyone in the world, except the privileged few in their protected retreats. It was a world gone wrong, the ultimate in entropy. Attempts to solve the problems by well-meaning groups of citizens could not work, because the solutions they conceived could only be local in scope, and the problems were global. The great chaos also extended to the human colonies in space, and brought a sudden end to a glorious chapter in the history of exploration. As the economic disaster spread on the home planet, the scattered colonies around the solar system, which could not exist without regular infusions of money, supplies, and personnel, quickly became the forgotten stepchildren of the people on Earth. As a result, almost half of the residents of the colonies had left to return home by 2040, the living conditions in their adopted homes having deteriorated to the point where even the twin difficulties of readjustment to Earth's gravity and the terrible poverty throughout the world were preferred over continuing to stay, most likely to die, in the colonies. The emigration process accelerated in 2141 and 2142, years characterized by mechanical breakdowns in the artificial ecosystems at the colonies, and the beginning of a disastrous shortage of spare parts for the entire fleet of robot vehicles used to sustain the new settlements. By 2143, only a very few hardcore colonists remained on the Moon and Mars. Communications between Earth and the colonies had become intermittent and erratic. Monies to maintain even the radio links with the outlying settlements were no longer available. The United Planets had ceased to exist 2 years previously. There was no all-human forum addressing the problems of the species. The Council of Governments would not be formed for 5 more years. The 2 remaining colonies struggled vainly to avoid death. In the following year, 2144, the last significant manned space mission of the time period took place. The mission was a rescue sortie piloted by an amazing Mexican woman named Benita Garcia. Using a jerry-rigged spacecraft thrown together from old parts, Ms. Garcia and her 3-man crew somehow managed to reach the geosynchronous orbit of the Lane cruiser James Martin, the last interplanetary transport vehicle in service, and saved 24 members from the crew of 100 women and children being repatriated from Mars. In every space historian's mind, the rescue of the passengers on the James Martin marked the end of an era. Within 6 more months, the last remaining space stations were abandoned, and no human lifted off the Earth, bound for orbit, until almost 40 years later. By 2145, the struggling world had managed to see the importance of some of the international organizations neglected and maligned at the beginning of the Great Chaos. The most talented members of mankind, after having eschewed personal political involvement during the benign early decades of the century, began to understand that it would only be through the collective skills of the brightest and most capable humans that any semblance of civilized life could ever be restored. At first, the monumental cooperative efforts that resulted were only modestly successful. But they rekindled the fundamental optimism of the human spirit and started the renewal process. Slowly, ever so slowly, the elements of human civilization were put back into place. It was still another 2 years before the general recovery finally showed up in economic statistics. By 2147, the gross world product had dwindled to 7% of its level 6 years earlier. Unemployment in the developed nations averaged 35%. In some of the undeveloped nations, the combination of unemployed and underemployed amounted to 90% of the population. It is estimated that as many as 100 million people starved to death during the awful summer of 2142 alone, when a great drought and concomitant famine girdled the world in the tropical regions. The combination of an astronomical death rate from many causes and a minuscule birth rate, for who wanted to bring a child into such a hopeless world, caused the world's population to drop by almost 1 billion in the decade ending in 2150. The experience of the Great Chaos left a permanent scar on an entire generation. As the years passed, and the children born after its conclusion reached adolescence, they were confronted by parents who were cautious to the point of phobia. Life as a teenager in the 2160s and even the 2170s was very strict. The memories of the terrible traumas of their youth during the chaos haunted the adult generation and made them extremely rigid in their application of paternal discipline. To them, life was not a joyride at an amusement park.
It was a deadly serious affair, and only through a combination of solid values, self-control, and a steady commitment to a worthwhile goal was there a chance to achieve happiness. The society that emerged in the 2170s was therefore dramatically different from the freewheeling laissez-faireism of 50 years earlier. Many very old, established institutions, among them the nation-state, the Roman Catholic Church, and the English monarchy, had enjoyed a renaissance during the half-century interim. These institutions had prospered because they had adapted quickly and taken leadership positions in the restructuring that followed the chaos. By the late 2170s, when a semblance of stability had returned to the planet, interest in space began to build again. A new generation of observation and communication satellites was launched by the reconstituted International Space Agency, one of the administrative arms of the Council of Governments. At first, the space activity was cautious, and the budgets were very small. Only the developed nations participated actively. When piloted flights recommenced and were successful, a modest schedule of missions was planned for the decade of the 2190s. A new space academy to train cosmonauts for those missions opened in 2188 and had its first graduates 4 years later. On Earth, growth was achingly slow, but regular and predictable for most of the 20 years preceding the discovery of the second Raman spaceship in 2196. In a technological sense, mankind was at approximately the same overall level of development in 2196 as it had been 66 years earlier, when the first extraterrestrial craft had appeared. Recent spaceflight experience was much less, to be certain, at the time of the second encounter. However, in certain critical technical areas like medicine and information management, the human society of the last decade of the 22nd century was considerably more advanced than it had been in 2130. In one other component, the civilizations encountered by the two Raman spacecraft were markedly different. Many of the human beings alive in 2196, especially those who were older and held the policy-making positions in the governing structure, had lived through some of the very painful years of the Great Chaos. They knew the meaning of the word fear. And that powerful word shaped their deliberations as they debated the priorities that would guide a human mission to rendezvous with Rama II. Chapter 6. La Signora Sabatini.
So, you were working on your doctorate in physics at SMU when your husband made his famous prediction about supernova 2191A.
Elaine Brown was sitting in a large, soft chair in her living room. She was dressed in a stark brown suit, sexless, with a high-collar blouse. She looked stiff and anxious, as if she were ready for the interview to be completed.
I was in my second year, and David was my dissertation advisor, she said carefully, her eyes glancing furtively at her husband.
He was across the room, watching the proceedings from behind the cameras.
David worked very closely with his graduate students. Everybody knew that. It was one of the reasons why I chose SMU for my graduate work.
Francesca Sabatini looked beautiful. Her long blonde hair was flowing freely over her shoulders. She was wearing an expensive white silk blouse, trimmed by a royal blue scarf neatly folded around her neck. Her lounging pants were the same color as the scarf. She was sitting in a second chair next to Elaine. Two coffee cups were on the small table between them.
Dr. Brown was married at the time, wasn't he? I mean, during the period when he was your advisor.
Elaine reddened perceptibly as Francesca finished her question. The Italian journalist continued to smile at her, a disarmingly ingenuous smile, as if the question she had just asked was as simple and straightforward as 2 plus 2. Mrs. Brown hesitated, drew a breath, and then stammered slightly in giving her response.
In the beginning, yes. I believe that he still was, she answered. But his divorce was final before I finished my degree.
She stopped again, and then her face brightened.
He gave me an engagement ring for a graduation present, she said awkwardly.
Francesca Sabatini studied her subject.
I could easily tear you apart on that reply, she thought rapidly, with just a couple more questions. But that would not serve my purpose.
Okay, cut, Francesca blurted out suddenly. That's a wrap. Let's take a look, and then you can put all the equipment back in the truck.
The lead cameraman walked over to the side of robot camera number one, which had been programmed to stay in a close-up on Francesca, and entered three commands into the miniature keyboard on the side of the camera housing. Meanwhile, because Elaine had risen from her seat, robot camera number two was automatically backing away on its tripod legs and retracting its zoom lens. Another cameraman motioned to Elaine to stand still until he was able to disconnect the second camera. Within seconds, the director had programmed the automatic monitoring equipment to replay the last 5 minutes of the interview. The output of all three cameras was shown simultaneously, split screen, the composite picture of both Francesca and Elaine occupying the center of the monitor, with the tapes from the two close-up cameras on either side. Francesca was a consummate professional. She could tell quickly that she had the material she needed for this portion of the show. Dr. David Brown's wife, Elaine, was young, intelligent, earnest, plain, and not comfortable with the attention being focused on her. And it was all clearly there on tape. While Francesca was wrapping up the details with her crew and arranging to have the annotated interview composite delivered to her hotel at the Dallas Transportation Complex before her flight in the morning, Elaine Brown came back into the living room with a standard robot server, two different kinds of cheese, a bottle of wine, and plenty of glasses for everyone. Francesca glimpsed a frown on David Brown's face as Elaine announced that there would now be a small party to celebrate the end of the interview. The crew and Elaine gathered around the robot and the wine. David excused himself and walked out of the living room into the long hall that connected the back of the house, where all the bedrooms were, with the living quarters in the front. Francesca followed him.
"Excuse me, David," she said.
He turned around, his impatience clear.
"Don't forget that we still have some unfinished business. I promised an answer to Schmidt and Hagenest upon my return to Europe. They are anxious to proceed with the project."
"I haven't forgotten," he replied. "I just want to make certain first that your friend Reggie has finished interviewing my children." He heaved a sigh. "There are times when I wish I was a total unknown in the world." Francesca walked up close to him.
"I don't believe that for a minute," she said,
her eyes fixed on his.
"You're just nervous today because you can't control what your wife and children are saying to Reggie and me. And nothing is more important to you than control."
Dr. Brown started to reply, but was interrupted by a shriek of, "Mommy!" reverberating down the hall from its origin in a distant bedroom. Within seconds, a small boy, 6 or 7 years old, swept past David and Francesca and raced pell-mell into the arms of his mother, who was now standing in the doorway connecting the hall and the living room. Some of Elaine's wine sloshed out of her glass from the force of the collision with her son. She unconsciously licked it off her hand as she sought to comfort the little boy.
"What is it, Justin?"
she asked.
"That black man broke my dog,"
Justin whined between sobs.
"He kicked it in the butt, and now I can't make it work."
The little boy pointed back down the hall. Reggie Wilson and a teenage girl, tall, thin, very serious, were walking toward the rest of the group.
"Dad," said the girl, her eyes imploring David for help, "Mr. Wilson was talking to me about my pin collection when that damn robot dog came in and bit him on the leg. After peeing on him first. Justin had programmed him to make mischief." "She's lying," the crying little boy interrupted her with a shout. "She doesn't like Wally. She's never liked Wally."
Elaine had one hand on the back of her nearly hysterical son, and the other firmly around the stem of her wine glass. She would have been unsettled by the scene, even if she hadn't noticed the disapproval she was receiving from her husband. She quaffed the wine and put the glass on a nearby bookshelf.
"There, there, Justin," she said,
looking embarrassed.
"Calm down and tell Mom what happened." "That black man doesn't like me, and I don't like him. Wally knew it, so he bit him. Wally always protects me."
The girl, Angela, became more agitated.
"I knew something like this would happen. When Mr. Wilson was talking to me, Justin kept coming into my room and interrupting us, showing Mr. Wilson his games, his pets, his trophies, and even his clothes. Eventually, Mr. Wilson had to speak sharply to him. Next thing we know, Wally is running wild and Mr. Wilson has to defend himself." "She's a liar, Mom, a big liar. Tell her to stop."
Dr. David Brown had had enough of this commotion. "Elaine," he shouted angrily above the din, "get him out of here." He turned to his daughter as his wife pulled the weeping little boy through the door into the living room. "Angela," he said, his anger now raw and unconcealed, "I thought I told you not to fight with Justin today, under any circumstances." The girl recoiled from her father's attack. Tears welled up in her eyes. She started to say something, but Reggie Wilson walked between her and her father. "Excuse me, Dr. Brown," he interceded. "Angela really didn't do anything. Her story is basically correct. She...
Look, Wilson, David Brown said sharply. If you don't mind, I can handle my own family. He paused a moment to calm his anger. I'm terribly sorry for all this confusion, he continued in a subdued tone. But it will all be finished in another minute or so. The look he gave his daughter was cold and unkind. Go back to your room, Angela. I'll talk to you later. Call your mother and tell her I want her to pick you up before dinner. Francesca Sabatini watched with great interest as the entire scene unfolded. She saw David Brown's frustration, Elaine's lack of self-confidence. This is perfect, Francesca thought. Even better than I might have hoped. He will be very easy. The sleek silver train cruised the North Texas countryside at 250 kilometers per hour. Within minutes, the lights from the Dallas Transportation Complex appeared on the horizon. The DTC covered a mammoth area, almost 25 square kilometers. It was part airport, part train station, part small city. Originally constructed in 2185, both to handle the burgeoning long-distance air traffic and to provide an easy nexus for transferring passengers to the high-speed train system. It had grown, like other similar transportation centers around the world, into an entire community. More than 1,000 people, most of whom worked at the DTC and found life easier when there was no commute, lived in the apartments that formed a semicircle around the shopping center south of the main terminal. The terminal itself housed 4 major hotels, 17 restaurants, and over 100 different shops, including a branch of the chic Donatelli fashion chain.
I was 19 at the time, the young man was saying to Francesca.